Hello, and I'm really excited about this upcoming podcast today. We're going to have Ethan Evans on. If you have not heard about Ethan Evans, you're probably not on LinkedIn. Ethan has 90,000 followers and counting on LinkedIn. He talks the real deal about what it takes to grow your career in a corporate environment, how to become a leader, how to go from a leader to an executive, and he breaks it down with very tangible advice. We talk a lot in this episode about his experience as an Amazon bar raiser. We talk a lot about decisions in one's career and how to decide what sort of company to go to, what sort of role to go to. And we talk a lot about how to be proactive. And Ethan and I are very aligned with being proactive. I call it owning your career. He speaks a lot about proactivity. Essentially, we are one in the same in a lot of ways. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation between Ethan and myself. And before we dig into that, just a reminder, if you are someone who is looking to get a better job, or you're someone who got laid off and are looking to get a job, we at Kadima Careers help you do that. We have developed one of the best systems, the best frameworks that will get you more interviews, more offers, and more money through our proprietary growth framework. We help you do that in two primary ways. One, personalized coaching, where you will work with a world-class coach until you get a better job. And we guarantee to work with you until you do. Then we help you negotiate for more money. Then we help you hit the ground running in the first 90 days. Secondly, if you want a little bit less support from us, but you still want to be part of the Kadima community, we do offer a group coaching program as well. You can find out about both of these. Go to our website at kadimacareers.com, kadimacareers.com. And the last three words I will leave you with before this conversation with Ethan and I begin are own your career. Hello, and welcome to another Steer Your Career podcast. And on today's podcast, I'm really excited to have Ethan Evans. Ethan is someone I've been following on LinkedIn for, I don't know, a couple of years now or so. And then I heard him on Lenny's podcast. If you don't listen to Lenny's podcast, amazing podcast. Lenny does a hell of a lot better job at podcasting than I do. But Ethan is a former executive at Amazon. And now he is helping train leaders to become executives. And his stuff on LinkedIn is really top-notch, really good, thought-provoking, inside information about how it is to grow and develop as a leader. So before I tell Ethan's entire bio, I'll hand it over to Ethan to share a little bit more about himself.
Yeah, so thank you for having me here. I love to talk to people about developing their careers. So my bio is educated as an engineer, went through a master's degree, spent 12 years in startups, a few different startups. None of them did poorly. None of them did awesome. And then I was called by Amazon early, before AWS, before the Kindle. I joined Amazon, was part of creating Prime Video, and then did a number of other things there, ultimately leading a global team of 800 people. And along the way, I found I really enjoyed helping people develop in their careers. And so when I had the chance to step away from Amazon and do that instead, that became what I do today. As you mentioned, I write almost daily on LinkedIn. And I share a lot of messages in places like this because I want to help people both achieve career success and satisfaction, to be happy with what they're doing.
And it's interesting that you've taken such a focus on people and growing and developing people. At least my impression as an outsider from Amazon is that they focus a little less on growing and developing people and treat people more as cogs in the wheel. Like, I've had lots of clients that have gone into Amazon and within a month have had three different managers. And I'm curious, was your perspective and focus on growing and developing people at Amazon, was that an outlier? Were you seen as like a beacon there and attract a lot of people, or was that fairly common in the organization?
So I guess I wouldn't call myself a beacon, although maybe some people would, because I was something of an outlier. That said, there's a lot of leaders there who invest in their people. I would say the company as a whole, you've characterized correctly. The company doesn't philosophically do a lot of personnel investment. Their viewpoint is great people develop themselves, and it's up to us to give the opportunity and maybe a few nudges or guidance. If you've heard you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, I think Amazon's viewpoint is we can tell you the general direction of the water and then you go find it yourself. And ultimately, that works for a certain set of people. I chose to leave Amazon because I felt I had an opportunity to invest in people in a way that would benefit them that Amazon wasn't doing. So I first contacted the leadership in human resources a couple times and said, hey, as my last act at Amazon, I would love to come join HR and implement this vision of greater investment in the employee base. And at least what I was describing didn't resonate with them. And so that doesn't mean, I'm not saying that they don't care or anything like that, but I couldn't make a match between my vision and their vision. And so I realized, well, I'll go do it myself.
And there were a lot of areas where you did find your match and you got promoted multiple times. You were VP, mm-hmm. which is not easy to do at Amazon or any of these large tech companies. And Amazon has always impressed me for being very principle-based, and they have these famous leadership principles, the LPs. Now they're up to 16 mm-hmm. LPs. I heard on Lenny's podcast that you were responsible for helping to craft and influence one of them. I'd love to hear you talk about the one that was near and dear to your heart. Maybe there's more, but the one that you were very influential on.
So the story there is the leadership principles have been through maybe four major iterations. Going way back, for example, there's a leadership principle, hire and develop the best. In the beginning, it was only hire the best. And this predates me. By the time I got there, they had added develop. But when they were very young as a company, they were just focused on how do we hire the best people? And then they realized, oh, we have to add develop. Second, when they were going through one of these revisions, in the early days, there were three different lists. So there was like five leadership principles and five core values and I don't know, five traits or something. And they made a decision and said, let's make it one list. And in that process, they dropped one. And they dropped one called ownership. And ownership, I had talked about being personally invested in feeling like something is yours and your problem and your responsibility. The CEO of North American Retail, a guy named Jeff Wilkie, came to a group of us and said, here's our new list of leadership principles. What do you think? And we looked at them as a group, and several of us said, ownership is missing. And he argued with us at first. He's like, yeah, we took it out, this reason, that reason. And we said, yeah, we don't agree. And so he said, well, if you're so sure it should be there, write us a version. And so a group of us, a small group, sat down and created a version of the ownership leadership principle and said, here, we think it's important. Here's why we think it's important. And here's what we think it should say. And I kept a copy of that email over all the years. And the email I put early in my career, I ran into somebody that I was suggesting to them that they would be more effective if they did this extra analysis in their area or if they provided this extra value. And that person said to me, that's not my job. Would you like to see my job description? What struck me so much about that was the person was telling me not what you're saying is a bad idea, or I disagree that it's valuable, or I have higher priorities. Just, oh, that's not my job. Would you like to see my job description? And I was so taken aback by basically using a piece of paper that it stuck with me. So at Amazon, I created the words that went into the leadership principle. A leader never says that's not my job. Now, what we sent in to the leadership team got edited, but those words survived. And so I have the email where I sent those words in and then it's on the website. Those words are still there more than a decade later. And so I feel very good about having had that influence. That's kind of the whole story.
Nice. Another thing that you did at Amazon, which really makes you stand out, is you've interviewed a whole bunch of people. You became an Amazon Bar Raiser. Tell the audience a little bit about what an Amazon Bar Raiser is. I've had Amazon Bar Raisers on here before, but it's just a good reminder. And then I'd like to dig into what makes a good candidate versus a bad candidate in your mind. But share what your experience has been with recruiting. And you're not a recruiter. You've worked in the business line. But talk about your background in recruiting and interviewing and evaluating talent.
Well, I am an odd leader as a technical leader, because in my startups, You wouldn't expect the VP of engineering to own recruiting, but I did. So I actually have managed recruiters as an aside. But when I got to Amazon, I went quite a few years just interviewing. And then a friend of mine said, look, Ethan, you're avoiding being a bar raiser. You need to do this. And the reason he was right, I was avoiding it, is a form of extra work, because the role of a bar raiser is to, number one, be an experienced interviewer on the loop or the evaluation, but that's not the main point. The main point is the point of a bar raiser is A, to be an independent voice. The bar raiser is not part of the team that's hiring. And so the idea is hiring managers can be subject to a subtle internal pressure of, oh my God, I have 2 seats to fill, 3 seats to fill. I'm down this person. I'm going to hire this person because I need someone. The idea is the bar raiser can stand aside from that and say, yeah, so I know you need someone, but this is not someone we should take, and be that person with no skin in the game from a pain viewpoint, and therefore able to have a lot of skin in the game for what's best. That's one thing. The other thing a bar raiser does is they run the debrief. So when you get everyone together, their job is to be a facilitator and try to draw out, make sure that, for example, the loudest voice in the room isn't dominating, that subtle points are being connected. And so they're a facilitator to try to get all the right information on the table. And that overall is the two-part goal of a bar raiser: be the independent voice and then get everyone to be heard. Because sometimes you have someone who's, I hate this candidate, or someone else who's, I worked with this person at Acme Inc. and they're awesome. And you want to try to make sure those voices don't act as the only voice and drive the decision.
You're an expert at interviewing people. You've interviewed 2,500 people, I heard you say on Lenny's podcast.
Yes.
I've interviewed less than you. You're one of the few people that are not a recruiter that's interviewed more than me. I think I'm at about 2,000. What in your mind, like, I'm sure you've seen all different shades of people in those 2,500. I know I have some crazy stories on the positive, some amazing stories on the negative. Crazy stories on the negative, amazing stories on the positive. What are some tips that you have for people that are going through an interview, whether it's Amazon or other places, that can make or break one's ability to get on to the next round?
A few things. First, understand interview is largely social. Yes, your skills are being tested. Yes, your skills are being evaluated. But the number one and two factors, according to research in an interview, are appearance and enthusiasm. Now, appearance doesn't mean you need to be beautiful, but it does mean you have to either fit in, make the interviewer comfortable and mirror them. Or if you don't want to do that, you better be able to own your edginess in a way that comes off as a positive. But you want to appear like you fit the culture. Why? People are tribal. They're asking themselves, do I want to work with this person every day? If you have an extreme appearance, even though some people feel like, oh, don't cram me into that shoebox. If you have an extreme appearance, then you're calling attention to that rather than what you bring. So that's a decent reason that if conform a little in that circumstance is probably a better call. And if that really bothers you, that's okay. It's going to take you more interviews to get a job. Second, enthusiasm. People want to work with people that want to work with them. So be excited, be engaged. If the opposite of that, which everyone has seen, is the grumpy person who's like, I've heard some bad things about Amazon. You're going to need to convince me to work here. My viewpoint, if I'm the interviewer, is no, actually, I don't. There's candidates lined up out the door. I just need to flush you down the toilet and move on. And again, I'm giving you the far end of that. I've said a very provocative thing there, but if you chip in on your shoulder where you don't seem to be respecting and valuing the workplace, what you're communicating is, hey, Ethan, or hey, Alan, I think you may actually be a bad person working at a bad company, as opposed to a great person I'd like to be around. And nobody likes to be disliked. And so if you're not showing that respect, you're not going to get it. I'll continue to say then, for technical skills, be good at the give and take of, be ready with your stories, be ready to answer. But a secret weapon I can give your interviewers is use the question at least a few times, or at the end, or if you're unsure of your answer, did I answer your question? And the psychology there is, number one, it gives you a chance to let them talk and engage them in give and take. Number two, the way the human brain works, if they say yes, they may think that answer is only okay, but I'm going to say yes. Now they convince themselves it was a better answer, because the way your brain works, if I tell you I like something, I actually like it more. Conversely, if I say, no, actually, I was looking for this, then you get another chance to answer. You failed the question. But if I say to you, oh, Alan, I really wanted to know blah, 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 then you say, oh, great, I can tell you about that. And you get to fix your answer. So either way, you win. And so that's like a secret, you know, semi-secret tip that's really powerful.
I like that. Some interviewers will give you that information. Some won't. But there's no harm in asking.
Most, if you ask them, did I pass, most won't answer. But if you say, did I address your question? Or did I fully address your question? Most people don't see that as you asking, am I a good person? They see it as you checking for completion. And I think, well, you're right, there might be some people like, we'll find out. Or most people won't do that.
So you've had a very impressive career at Amazon, over 15 years there. And I know Amazon Pay is in a lot of RSUs and equities. So you did quite well there for yourself. And you talked about that in a recent LinkedIn post about how it grew like 100 times. And essentially your post was a little bit about like rising tides lift all boats type of thing. So you did well there. And you could have left Amazon and go on the ski slopes. But besides skiing, besides spending time with your family, you also chose to provide professional development at scale, guiding transitions to executive leadership. Why are you doing this? You could be skiing. You could be hanging out with your kids. You could be taking another job, doing a startup. Why did you choose this path and what are you trying to achieve with it?
Well, thank you, Alan. That's a fun question to answer. So I chose the path. Number one, I work half-time-ish. So I do choose to work, but I work totally on my own schedule. And so I feel like I'm doing a lot of the skiing and traveling and other things I would like to. When we're done talking here, I'll go have lunch with my wife. And then later today, we'll walk the dogs together. So I have a good balance there. But I retired at age 50, and I couldn't imagine either spending 30, 40 years on a beach only, or respecting myself if I did. I would feel like I was freeloading on humanity. And I'm very motivated. I hate to see people struggling or in pain. And so I'm very motivated to try and help people. And the place I'm best at helping people is with their careers. Because of my own career, it's what people trust me with, but it's also what I practice through all those years of mentoring and training and building my team. So I'm good at it. So it's an alignment of something people want with something I like to do, with something that I'm good at. And then for the long-term mission, the way I look at it is too many people are trapped, grinding away, trying to make a living, and they're not really able to do things to make the world a better place because they're so busy making a living. Amazon was an amazing company for me. It's a miraculous company. I still own a ton of their stock, but Amazon is not really curing cancer. If you look at all the businesses Amazon are in, they're great businesses that we need. I worked mostly in entertainment. They entertain people. They make Prime Video, they make games, whatever. They sell you things. You need dishes or a book, they'll get it to you. You need servers, they'll get it to you. But none of those things feel like righting wrongs or changing climate or whatever your cause might be. And so I want to free more people to be involved in the things humanity needs and less people to be involved in making a living delivering the basics. And so that's my bigger mission.
Although you'd argue now they're buying One Medical. Maybe it's just trying to sell more medical products. But I think on the positive side, maybe they're trying to solve this terrible healthcare situation that we have in this country.
I think that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought it up. I very much think, based on what I know from having been inside the company, not like super secret knowledge, in the early days, Jeff would have avoided medical because it's highly regulated, very complex, and there's lots of existing players. So he, I believe, would have looked at that and said, that isn't our space. But eventually the pain of dealing with the existing healthcare system was so bad that Jeff said, you know what, even though it's not our space, we're going to wade in because we must fix it or must try to contribute to it. So I actually do think that's a case where Amazon has a financial plan. I'm sure they intend to make money, but also has an altruistic or social plan, which is great.
And to Jeff's credit and Andy Jassy, who's there now, I appreciate that they're trying multiple approaches. I think they tried first with Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon to do something. I don't know what's going on with that. I think it's fizzled out, but kudos to Amazon for continuing to try this out. And if anyone's going to solve it, I trust Amazon to solve it more so than our government. As you're focused on your passion project and what you were talking about, what you're good at, what you like doing, I'm sure you've heard the term ikigai, the Japanese term.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's how I fell into my career. And ikigai, like if you look at the translation, it's what you're good at, what you're like doing, what the world needs, and what people will pay for. And when you have those, that Venn diagram in the perfect formation, that's your reason for living, essentially. That's what Wikipedia's definition is of it anyway. but as you work with people and you're trying to do it at scale, so you do one-on-one coaching. I know you do a lot of digital courses and lots of speaking opportunities. What's your goal with this? Because you can impact people one-on-one. You can impact people in mass. You can have the approach like Amazon, where if it's not a billion people, it's not worth it. Or what's your goal?
I spent 15 years, the heart of my career and all of my leadership career at Amazon. So I am deeply steeped in the scale piece. And recently I've been thinking about this. I did and still do a fair amount of one-on-one coaching, but as my profile as an author and a writer about career has gone on, my coaching service became overwhelmed. So I mentioned I work 2 to 3 days a week equivalent. I could easily coach 6 days a week now. Like I have the demand and the clients and I don't want that. A, I don't want it for my life. And B, even if I coach very heavily, I'm one-on-one helping 100 people. And if they each say manage 100, even then you could say you're helping the people they manage. Then I help maybe 10,000, which is still awesome, but I made a post on LinkedIn this morning. In 3 hours, it's gone to 60,000 people. And, you know, it'll end at, I don't know, I'm pretty good at predicting the algorithm at this point. It'll end in the low 100, like 120, 150,000 people will see it. That was an hour of effort to write it, to craft it, to get it edited, to post it. 1 hour, 150,000 people, as opposed to 100 hours of coaching 100 leaders, 10,000 people. I'm more oriented towards scale. And so I've closed my coaching service to new clients because I will take care of the clients I have while they need me. But I think leverage, I want to have the big, broad impact. And I accept that it's not as deep. A course or a piece of writing isn't like a 1 hour give and take with a client. You can do more good for that one person, but I still believe the scale is a better call for me.
And with your work of supporting 10,000, 100,000, million people. You talk a lot about helping leaders move into executives. Is that what really drives you? And what is the difference in your mind between a leader and an executive and what sort of impact they have on other people in the organization?
Yeah. So while that is the tagline I use and like the sweet spot I've found, because there's a lot of people in middle management who feel stuck and can't figure out why they're unable to move up. But I definitely view my role, and if you look at what I write about, the writing is more for people earlier in their career. So I definitely see, I have a two-tier strategy essentially, which is write for everybody. But the people who are going to pay for a bespoke course are generally the ones who are a little further along and have, there's a good saying, if you like product development, there's a good saying that's be a painkiller, not a vitamin. Vitamins are something you take that are like, you should take. They're good for you. If you miss them this day, it's hard to tell the difference. They're like this long-term investment. But everybody, when they have a headache, goes and gets some Advil. And so with the people who feel stuck in their careers, I provide them a painkiller solution. I will give you a recipe to get unstuck. For everyone else, the long-term writing is more the vitamins. Here's the easy thing you can do every morning to like move your life along in a career direction. And so it's a two-piece strategy. And that's why you see that. Now, why do I focus on the executive piece? It's because I identified a few key things that I think separate people who are not getting there from those who are. And part of that relationship, the biggest single belief, I guess, to simplify, I'm going to try and simplify tons of teaching into one point so it won't be a perfect fit. You're reducing a book to a tweet. But I think that tweet is a lot of people don't think they should have to do anything other than be great. In other words, I work hard, I get a lot done, my team gets a lot done, I must be an executive. Like, I'm qualified. There's a lot of smart people who work hard, and there is more to it than that. It's great that you do all those things, and I'm taking nothing away from it. But I call that work hard and hope to be noticed. And that isn't enough of a career plan.
I've noticed in my career at Google and Meta and Salesforce, I don't know if there's any data on this, and I'm sure you would know, that the people that moved up the quickest and the highest did a hell of a lot better job of, it appeared to me at least, managing up well than managing down well. So there was less likely for the senior leaders to actually be good people managers and good people leaders. But they presented well. So did you find that as well? That was a quicker or a more effective path to kiss up and kick down? And that's an extreme view of it. But I personally always did a better job of managing down than up. I did, and that got me fired a few times. But did you see that as well in your space? I'd love your perspective on the amount of time and effort of managing the team and keeping your team motivated. And I'm not talking about taking them out for beers and patting them on the back all the time, but focused on the team needs versus focused on the leader's needs. And you need to do both. But I just saw the people that rose quicker. It seemed like they were spending a disproportionate amount of time on managing up than managing down.
While that's sad, it's true. And we can talk about why. We should talk about why. But the trick is, it doesn't, what you're saying is true, but it doesn't have to be. You can choose to be both a good manager down and a good manager up. But this is, again, where people get stuck. See, they're good managing down and they wonder why that's not getting them where they need to go. And it's because they're not good at managing up. And then they get mad. And they're like, well, I shouldn't have to do that. That's kissing up. Yes and no. It's being effective. It's making your manager's job easier because you're feeding them what they need from you, and you're good at matching your style to theirs so that it's comfortable, and you're good at building relationships with the leaders so that they interact with you easily. Because one of the choices that gets made in a leadership promotion, not technically, it's nowhere on the piece of paper, but it's, do we want to work with Ethan more? Do we want Ethan to be in the room with us more? And I recently had a very strong leader at Amazon, it happens. But what they told me, and they said I could share it, was, look, one of the things we evaluate is, do you bring energy into a room when you come in, or do you suck it out? Are you a person that's unpleasant to have in the room or pleasant? Some people would say, I'm the truth teller, so maybe I irritate a room, but I'm the person bringing the facts and telling them like it is. Yeah. And they'll invite you in when they desperately need you and no other time, because you're no fun. And you can hate that, but you won't make it false. Now, nothing I've said means that you have to lie or that you have to fundamentally change who you are. It just means be nice and be friendly and find ways to work with people. And that doesn't have to be a compromise. And also, nothing I've said says, oh, grind your team up and don't care about them and drive them and wring them out. But a lot of people take that approach. They're like, I coach people who it's clear that their boss's opinion of them is, I value you as much as you help my career. And if you're good at helping my career and delivering shit that makes me look good, I will keep you and pat you on the head enough to keep you. And if you're not, I'll discard you. That I don't agree with that. I spend a lot of time on how managers can be better, but there's truth to that, that sometimes jerks move up.
And you moved up. We'll assume you're not a jerk. At least everything I know about you, you don't appear to be a jerk. But who knows?
I'm sure we can find some people who think I am.
Yeah, I'm sure you ruffled some feathers along the way. I'm sure not everybody likes you. I know not everybody likes me, and that's not the sign of a good leader. But you were at Amazon for 15 and a half years, and I was looking at your LinkedIn profile, and it looks like you worked for 6 or 7 organizations before Amazon, nothing more than 4 years.
Right.
Approximately. What kept you at Amazon for so long, the 15 and a half years? And how do you think about people that move around more and less? And how should people think about that?
In American myth and legend, being in startups is the hottest, sexiest thing out there. If you just bake off the sort of appeal or shininess of, I work at a big tech company, no, I'm part of a hot startup. on average, most people would say the hot startup is the place to be. But I did better inside Amazon. I did better because at the startup, the reality of the startup is you're always looking over your shoulder at the bank account and watching it go down as you're trying to make money. And most startups don't succeed. And so you have this constant stress of, are we going to get a bridge loan and are we going to get more funding? And it also happened, I was in startups in some rough economic times. And so those startups, I either had to lay people off or whatever. I got to Amazon. Amazon had a running money engine. And so all I had to worry about was do great work. I was freed from the hard challenges of a startup around funding. And it was only could I build a better thing. I thrived there. And so one thing that kept me at Amazon was it was going so well. Now, the other thing you alluded to, I was at Amazon at a period that has existed in almost no other companies on earth, a period of 100-fold growth. So I had the advantage of being at a stable, financially stable run company where I didn't have to worry about money or funding or layoffs, and yet a company that was having startup-like growth over and over again. And I really got the best of both worlds. Now, if my only goal was career trajectory, I probably would have gotten even higher if I had left Amazon at the right points. Particularly later in my career, like very late in my career, I had some solicitations to go to other well-known companies, including Meta, which you mentioned, for very lofty roles. I didn't take them because they either meant relocating, which just wasn't worth it to me at that point in my career, or at some point I was within 2 or 3 years of feeling I was going to make a change to do my own thing, like planning on leaving. And I didn't feel it was right to take like a big position again at say Meta, knowing that I was only going to give it 2 years. Now, some people, and I honor this, would have been like, yeah, 2 years is fine. Go collect your extra money and have your impact and leave. I didn't. And so I didn't do that. But I'm not sure, as much as I love Amazon, and for that matter, Google, Meta, et cetera, have been famous, I'm not sure any of them, if you want high growth, are great places for a 15-year career now, because they don't have that same growth curve. Now, they can still be great 15-year careers if you want to work on super high-scale things that are very technical and very deep. But if what you want is high growth, which is my specialty, I'm not sure they're the best places for that anymore.
So if you are an ambitious professional that's looking for high growth, and you can't predict that Amazon was going to do 100 times growth.
No, I had no idea.
They were like threatened to be penny stocks at a point during like the dot-com bubble burst, and they might have gone under if there were some bad factors that occurred. So assuming that most people... nobody can predict 100 times growth, because if so, we would just all invest in that company.
Yeah, we'd just all go to the stock market. Great.
Yeah. So assuming we can't count on that, what advice do you give for people that do want to accelerate their career, do want to grow their career?
One thing, we can't predict 100 times growth, but we can predict probable growth rates. There was a commenter on one of my posts recently. I won't name the name or the company, but she tagged me in on a company in another industry that had seen 4% growth, and they were having a celebratory post about how their results in 2023 were 4% better than 2022. And she tagged me in and said, is this enough growth, Ethan? It's a little tweaky. And I wrote back in a private message, I wasn't going to poop on this company in public. But I said, look, inflation last year was 4%. So if I sold a candy bar for $1 in 2022, I should expect to make $1.04 in 2023. And I still only sold the same candy bar. So 4% growth isn't even growth. It's arguably shrinkage relative. And that's just truth. There's many industries that aren't going to see fast growth. The one company you can call it I pick on as an example is, I say, the post office. If you join the post office, and there is one person in my extended network of people who once took a job for the Canadian post office, you can't expect that to go anywhere. Right? It's just, there's not. First, the post office as a whole is an industry that's going in, like being eliminated. And second, there's no goal for innovation. There's nothing going to happen there. You can't predict 100x growth. I guess you'd say you can predict not 100x growth. So thing one is avoid that. But then I would say thing two is you may need to be a little more mercenary in two ways. Work hard for a couple of years somewhere, But if traction's not coming and that company's not growing, take another swing. One way to find 100x growth, you can't predict it, but you have a better chance of finding it if you work at six places than if you stay at the same one that's growing 4%. Second, you can get moved up as you move. And so if you pick the right times in the economy when demand is high and you've done good work, plenty of people bounce. I have another friend. I won't go through the whole story. Some real clever sleuth on LinkedIn might be able to figure out who I'm talking about, and that'll be okay. He left Amazon, and ultimately he took a job at Sears, which was circling the drain hard. Yeah. And I told him when he went there, I'm like, this thing is circling the drain, and they're hiring you as a Hail Mary. Their theory, Sears' theory, the leader's theory at that point was, we're going to get us some Amazon people, and they're going to fix it. And I'm like, yeah, 1%. 99% it goes on down the drain. He's yes. But my title today, like I'm a senior manager and they're offering me a VP role with three times the pay, guaranteed, practically put in escrow. Like we will pay you even if we go bankrupt. And he was right. What he did that was super clever, he left a mid-level job at Amazon. He took this circling the drain, headed down the gutter job at Sears. He put in a couple years of hard effort. He collected a seven-figure paycheck for doing that. That's victory one. And then he came out of there with a VP title. And this is a good friend of mine, so I hope he's not insulted. He went from a shit company, Sears, to a mid-tier company that hired him as a VP because he'd been a VP.
Yeah.
And now he owns his life.
Yeah.
He parlayed being at a great company at a mid-tier into being at really high at a terrible company to being really high at a fine company, but not a great one, to being anything he wants to be. And actually, it was brilliant. So that's a different strategy.
And I think in every situation, you almost have to compare to your BATNR, your best alternative to negotiated mm-hmm. agreement, of what your individual situation is during that time. I know you're not someone who likes to poop on companies, but on the flip side, are there some companies?
Sears, it was okay pooping on Sears.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone can poop on Sears and Kmart. Yeah.
The post office.
Are there some companies that you either recommend your clients or that you're pretty bullish on that you think that no one can predict 100 times growth, but you think that, hey, look at these handful of companies and you'll probably be okay for a few years and grow nicely? I have some in my mind, but I'd be curious to hear yours.
I don't think about that question too much, to be honest, because I feel it's hard to predict. And also, I'm not personally in that market. That said, I think more in terms of industries. I think AI is overhyped and overfull. I'm going to join a hot AI startup would be a facepalm for me at this point. Like, oh, that's not going to work. Fintech, I feel, again, so many people have run towards it in the last few years, somewhat driven by crypto. There may be great examples there. You want to figure out where you can go that's somewhat early on its innovation curve. And so there's a lot of evidence that would say biotech has a lot of potential. Even though biotech's been around a long time, the demographics of aging is pushing more and more people who have a lot of money towards wanting lifestyle solutions. So I would be looking at like the world's wealthy, not just America's wealthy, but the world's wealthy are aging. The world, of course, faces climate issues. So there are going to be winners in the climate space, partly driven by government desperation. Again, I don't have the perfect solution there, but I think here's what I'll do that's better for you. Jeff Bezos was once said, he was often asked what was going to change in the future. And he said, I don't know. What's more interesting is to know what's not going to change. Because if something's not going to change, you can build a business on it. And his example of this was he eventually concluded that the right thing for Amazon to focus on as a retailer was what he called price selection and convenience. And his point was, there will never be a day in history where people say to themselves, gee, I wish I had fewer choices of what to buy and that they cost more and were harder to get.
Yeah.
That will never happen. So as long as we are giving people more choices that are easier to get at lower prices, we will perpetually be improving our business. And we can count on that forever. So you're trying to find what's never going to change. When I think about what I teach, and it frustrates some people, I try to teach human nature hasn't changed. if you pick your favorite holy book from any religion and look at what it says about people, it talks about them lying and cheating and stealing. We call those sins. And it talks about their different greed and whatever. Human traits are going to be the same. They have been for 2,000 years. They're going to be for another 2,000 years. So for career, you can count on people being self-interested. And so you focus on, what does that mean? And how do I survive in a world where most of the people around me are mostly interested in themselves?
That's true. And ultimately, I think it goes back to your point of Amazon's philosophy of you can lead people to water, but they, or the horses to water, but they have to drink it for themselves. And people have to be like proactive about their career because no one else is going to be focused on their career because everyone's self-interested in themselves, maybe outside of your mom or dad or a husband or wife. But even there, sometimes those selflessness aspects break down.
Yeah. Just a quote I often give people there, and I know you're wrapping up, is if my job was to worry about your career, it would be called my career, and I already have one, right? My job is to worry about my career. Even if I'm your man, see, this is another place people get lost is they think it's my manager's job to guide my career. No, your manager is worried about their career.
Yep.
Another great mental model, and this is the last one I'll give you. If you've worked in a job with a boss, a manager, think about how much time you spend thinking about what your manager believes about your work. Oh, I wonder what they think about this, or I wonder what they want me to do here, or am I going to get in trouble for this, or am I going to get rewarded for that? You spend a lot of time thinking about what the manager might do. And yet you have this idea that they're going to spend that much time thinking about you, or they should. They're actually doing that right on up the chain. Yeah. Exactly. They're all of their mental energy the same. Just ask yourself, how often do you really spend time thinking, if you have reports, if you have anybody who works for you, how often do you really spend time thinking about what they need? Yes, you do. And you're a good manager and you think about them occasionally, but you think probably about yourself way more. That's just the imbalance. Deal with the reality. You can try and be a little bit better as a manager yourself. I'm not saying be selfish, but realize the person above you probably is selfish, subconsciously.
Yes, or very consciously.
Sometimes.
Awesome, Ethan. This was an unbelievable conversation. We can go on and on, but I want to be respectful of your time. You're going out with your wife, walking your dogs. I want to make sure you can get to that. The last two questions I have for you, and you've dropped lots of words of wisdom here, but what is one last piece of sick career advice you'd like to offer the ambitious professionals out here that are listening to the Sick Career Podcast?
Be proactive. Take action yourself. Do not wait to be told. If or when I write a book, I may title it Proactive, because if I boiled everything I advise people down to a single word, that makes the difference between average performers and great performers.
Stephen Covey, when he wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, number one is be proactive.
There you go. It's not original, apparently.
No. But, it's not. Imitation is the best form of flattery, right?
Flattery. Yeah. You could write a whole book just on, I believe I could write a whole book just on proactivity.
Yeah. And I don't think he invented that concept either. He just
articulated
and market the 7 Habits. And the last question I have for you, Ethan, I think I know the answer here, but please share with the audience. How can people follow you, find you, support you and your work?
Yeah, awesome. So the easiest place to find me is on LinkedIn. Ethan Evans VP is my handle there. But if you search for Ethan Evans, either on Google or LinkedIn, you're going to find me. I do a lot of things. They're all linked off my website or whatever, where I teach classes. I have a newsletter, but all of it can be found through LinkedIn or Google and my name.
Great, Ethan. Thank you so much for the time. And I really appreciate all the wisdom you've shared, not just here with me, on Lenny's podcast, on your LinkedIn posts that I look at on a daily basis, and I'm always learning from you. So I appreciate all your generosity and insight.
Thank you. I love to help people. I truly love it. And I'm trying very hard to do the best writing I can to help the most people I can.
Awesome, Ethan. Thank you.